Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 34th Annual Alumni Banquet. The first banquet was held in 1939, honoring graduates of the University of Alaska. While I wasn't here at that time, I can tell you that this hall is quite a departure from the buildings that were present even when I went to school here. I graduated in 1947. My name is Bill Hardy. I think I'm a late substitute for some polished master of ceremonies, and when Betty called me a couple of weeks ago, I felt quite honored. I didn't exactly feel honored. I felt kind of like the guy whose mother-in-law drove his new Cadillac over the cliff. But then my attitude towards this was something like a little story that I was told one time by a Catholic priest. And there was a fellow by the name of Paddy Murphy who was an airman stationed in Ireland. And Paddy had met a little Irish colleen by the name of Kathleen O'Reilly, and they had been going together for a couple of months, and they were really moving rather rapidly in the romantic situation. They'd almost gotten to the hand-holding stage, and one day they were walking along the street, and Paddy said to Kathleen, "Kathleen, I'm so delighted. I'm so happy to be here." And he said, "All my life I've dreamed about walking with and meeting and loving an Irish colleen. My father told me about these wonderful Irish girls, and he said, I am just filled with joy at knowing you." He said, "All my life I've dreamt about kissing an Irish colleen who has kissed the Blarney Stone." Well, Kathleen had heard about these kind of fast American types, and she said, "Well, Patrick, of course, I'll see if I can't find you one. Of course, now I have sat on it." I should like to now introduce the head table. On the far right is Betty Harrop Clark, the instigator of these wonderful alumni banquets, and the retiring secretary of the Alumni Association. Next to her is her assistant, Dr. William Wood. And his wife, Dorothy Jane Wood. And next to her is Dr. Scheibel, who is a practicing physician in Fairbanks and who will be honored tomorrow at the graduation. Next to Dr. Scheibel is an alumnus of the university, the class of 1949, Grace Scheibel, who is president of the board of directors of the UA Alumni Association. And then is Dr. Don Defoe, who is vice president of the statewide services of the university. And his lovely wife and fellow committee member of mine, Lois Defoe. On my left is a student selected by the students of the university to sit next to me at this dinner, Mrs. Wanda Mead. And then the class of 64, Terry McLean, president of the Fairbanks chapter. And his wife, next to him, Daphne McLean, class of 65. Then is Dr. President Bill O'Neill, president of the Board of Regents of the University of Alaska. And his wife, Vi O'Neill. There are several other distinguished guests in the hall tonight, and there are so many that it's impossible to pick out all of the wonderful people who have come here to help the new class of 1972 be inducted into this wonderful fraternity of the Alumni Association of the University of Alaska. I see a few very auspicious people whom I shall mention, though. The first one is Mrs. Lola Tilley, who was my home economics teacher when I was a student here. My stockbroker, Roger Hughes. I don't know her name, but some lady sold me license tags today. She's not there. Automobile license tags. Sorry. Well, I saw her back there along. Well, has Senator Gravel come in? Senator Gravel is supposed to be here tonight. I haven't seen him come in yet. May I now introduce the president of the Fairbanks chapter of the University of Alaska Alumni Association, Terry McLean.
Well, that's really something to have the MC give you a welcoming address for you. It really is. I don't know what he didn't touch that I had on my notes. At any rate, welcome to fabulous Fairbanks, those of you alumni that are here from Anchorage and other parts of the state. Last year, we were going through basically the same thing, whether or not the Chena River was going to flood or wasn't it. Latest reading, it is down again. Whenever we have these gatherings of the Alumni Association, we always come across many old faces and many new faces. Of course, now at the university, we're also coming across many new buildings. I can remember back, and being a graduate of the class of 64, it doesn't seem like it's been that long. The old main building, the old ROTC building, the old Hess Hall building, the old. As we drove up tonight, I noticed it's all the new. I'd like to mention in this brief welcoming Bill, address. Some of our absentee members that couldn't be with us tonight, Senator Terry Miller, Representatives Mike Bradner and Andy Warwick. I do hope they'll hurry home. We are very, very proud of those of you that represent the class of 1972. We sincerely hope that as you step out into our world today, that you'll take many, many fond memories of the university with you and many of the experiences that you've had here. Again, I'd like to welcome you, especially the class of 72, to our annual alumni banquet, and we do hope that you will stay in touch with us and do keep in touch. Let us know where you are. And if we, the alumni, can be of assistance to you, we are here and we would be happy to help you. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry, for the brief address. Now we will have the introduction of the members of the class of 1972. Betty, would you come here, please?
Honored guests. Can you hear me back there? No.
Did you cut me off?
Can't do that. Anything I can't stand is not have people hear me when I'm talking. Now can you hear me? No? Better? 1, 2, 3, 4, testing. Can you hear me now? Okay. If I'd known those words that Terry was going to say, I could have just given him the list of the graduates and had him read those off, too, and you wouldn't have had to listen to me. However, since he didn't, Terry, I will introduce to you and to all of you, the class of 72, all those members who are here tonight. Not everybody could come. We're very sorry that they couldn't. But when I call your name, you class of 72, would you please stand and remain standing? Glenda Anderson, Mark Anderson, please stay, remain standing, Glenda. John Angayak, Roger Alaba, Michael Avery, Gene Babb, Percy Barr, Ralph Beislein, Chris Birch, Margaret Bigsby, Mary Bohannon, and I have a little note up says they're married to one another. Maxie Bueller, Richard Bush, Barbara Carlson, Ken Chaddock, Thomas Chadwick, Julian Chase. There's one fellow in the back of the room. I'm not sure he needs a hearing aid or he can't hear me. Are you trying to tell me you can't hear me? Okay. Alan Cheek, Georgette Cheek, Patrick Cole, Ann Cook, Hazel Darrow, Howard Delo, Brian Dropko, Dennis Dooley, Lawrence Duffy, Gary Eddy, William K. Evans, Gary Farnsworth, Robert Feeks, Stanley Firo, Craig Fletcher, Susan Foxwell, Robert Gilfillian, June Gorham, Henry Grant, Dave Hackney, Stephen Halburn, Audrey Hardin, Peter Hartle, Eileen Head, Frank Henry, Betsy Jane Hines, Beverly Johnson, Vivica Johnson, David Jones, Taylor Jones, Glenn Kangas, Peter Kelly, James Kirka and Mary Kirka, they're also married to one another, Jackie Larkins, Meng Lee, Jim Lentine, Linda Lindig, Eric McKinnon, Marcia Major, Barbara McHattie, Clarice Millam, Tom Monk, Judy Maravoli, Arvin Nixon, Lola Oliver, Robert Orr, Donald Lee Parker, Carlton Peterson, Mary C. Pig, Barbara and Randy Pitney, Rosalind Powers, Brian Robertson, Mary Jean Roll, Michael Rugani, Pearl Seelid, Larry Schweigert, Leonard Sherwin, Judith Shore, Leslie Smith, Arnold Snyder, Ann Stribling, Michael Thomas, Ron Thornton, Steve Tricamo, Roger Stoit, Tony Vasca, Colleen Vondresik, Sam Ward, Jonathan Wittes, Pat Weissel, Jerry Wolf, and Karen Zellmer. Let's all give them a big hand. As Executive Secretary of the Alumni Association, I'd like to welcome all of you into the association. You will be getting cards, complimentary cards, that are good for 1 year. After that, in order to become an active alumnus, we expect you to sort of give something toward the association. We also would like for you to keep in touch. We're the only office on the campus that keeps in touch with the alumni, those who leave there. We want to know what you're doing. If you marry, multiply, be sure and let us know. So that we do put out a magazine, And we have alumni news in it. We put that news into the magazine so that all your friends know where you are and what you're doing. So keep in touch with us. It's really important. I'll leave you with just one little thought. Keep smiling. It makes people wonder what you've been up to.
Can you hear better in the back yet? Is this any better? We'll keep going until we get feedback and drive all the way back to you. Just one moment. Can you hear it back there?
There you go.
It's dangerous.
This looks a little threatening here, but we'll try it. Thank you very much, Betty. Every year at these Alumni Association banquets, they introduce members of honored classes. Usually it's classes of 10 years ago and 20 years ago and 30 and so on backwards. Tonight we should like to introduce members of the classes of 1932, 42, 52, and 62. Those present tonight from 1932 are Norma Clausen Smith. Would you stand up, please? Al Paulette. And Robert Lyle. Thank you very much. From the class of 1942, John W. Kessel. Thank you. From 1952, George Schmidt. Roger Hughes. 1953, thank you very much. Now, Dr. Don Defoe, who, as I mentioned before, is the Vice President of Public Service and who is one of the world's great travelers, will give a few comments on a subject that he has chosen on random observations. Don?
Well, that's the sign of old age, you know, you have to grow up for your glasses. Up to this time, I've considered this to be a wonderful evening, and I hate to detract from it, but nonetheless, one gets into this type of situation. I suppose some of you are familiar with the writings of Don Marquis and those delightful autobiographies of cats, Archie and Archie and Mehitable. I particularly like one line from the Archie and Mehitable, where Mehitable, who is obviously the female of the team, says this: "What did I ever do to deserve all these kittens?" Well, I often wonder what I do to deserve this type of assignment, and I think perhaps some of it is the fact that as a mere vice president and in an obscure area such as public service, that we don't get many opportunities, so that when we do, why, we want to be sure to take advantage of it. But I want to assure you that I've been worrying about this assignment for quite a little time, but I think that I haven't been worrying about it to the extent to go into a lot of preparation. I went into a near panic tonight just before we came over here, and ordinarily I write my notes for a speech on the back of an envelope, but I thought I'd better become a little more sophisticated since I've read speeches of Dr. Wood and others and that are quite profound, and so I thought at least this time I'd make some notes. So I did, and I had my secretary type them up. And when I got checking, I found that pages 49 to 72 were missing. And, you know, figuring at 2 minutes a page, that's going to do quite a little bit to the length of my remarks tonight, and I want you to understand that that's what's happened. Of course, the lack of preparation, which may be evident, I have a good alibi for it. Anyone who works for President Wood has quite an unusual type of assignment. He has a philosophy which he expresses to us when we come with him in the university, and that is that he's going to give us enough work to keep us off the streets at night. And he's been highly successful in my case, but I think that he's a highly reasonable employer. He really doesn't ask any more of us than of himself. He devotes all of his time to the university, and he only expects us to put in 3/4. So it's a reasonable arrangement. You can also, I think, understand how a person in my position might be undergoing a certain amount of trauma at the prospect of speaking before students who can be a critical audience, before alumni who have become taxpayers and therefore are a particularly critical group, and then before the president and the regents. I think, however, it gives me a chance to talk to them without them talking back, which I certainly relish. I could be tempted to offer some insights into what goes on actually in the regents' meetings, a little bit, insight, personal glimpses, an expose, but then I'm a few years away from voluntary retirement, so I've decided against that. I also might give you some insights into the president and how he expresses himself in the meetings of the Administrative Council. But I'm afraid that he might be tempted to make the same type of remark as the president of another university made when they asked him what had happened to a certain vice president. And he said, "He went as he came, fired with enthusiasm." So my remarks have been tempered by all those cautions which have come about. Somebody asked me what I was going to talk about, and I said, well, as usual, random observations. So they took that as a title, but I'm going to be a little more sophisticated. I'm going to give you a title, a little different one than that, and I hope by the end maybe that it has some bearing. And I'm going to use a title called Let's Look for the Pony. And I do that at the urging of some of my friends on the Administrative Council. I had a little chance to talk with Jim Lentine tonight and was delighted to meet his parents and his sister from New Jersey. And I recalled the speech that Jim made at a dinner last October here in Fairbanks as a testimonial to Dr. Wood. And Jim, I thought, made the best speech of the evening and certainly the best short story, in which he said that he'd often wondered what a president of a university did, but after considerable research, he'd found out. He said, a president has a board of regents to deal with, and he has vice presidents to deal with. Now, the board of regents are supposed to think, and the vice presidents are supposed to make speeches. So the problem of a president and his role is to keep the vice presidents from thinking and the regents from making speeches. As one sits sometimes in meetings either of the vice presidents or of the regents, you wonder whether or not he's able to keep that role entirely straight. He and I were talking the other morning, and I think we all realize that the president of the university stands in a highly vulnerable position. He's visible, he's shot at. When you're a comparatively tall fellow like Dr. Wood, you make a pretty broad target sometimes, and it's easy to hit, and I'll say for him that he doesn't try to hide behind a rock and not be the target. But I remarked that being a president was something like living in a goldfish bowl, and he said, yes, he didn't mind that so much, but it seemed like somebody was always trying to poison the water. You might ask what vice presidents do. Well, you can read various manuals and publications of the university, and there are descriptions which describe which each one of us are supposed to do. I might add that the assignments we have can be instantly and dramatically modified, however, by the president, so the description can be somewhat meaningless. I think there are certainly impressions as far as the students and faculty and regents and the public of what we do. I heard the story the other day about the vice president of another institution who went to hell, and it took him 3 weeks to notice any difference in climate or working conditions. Now, that's, of course, not true here, but we do have our problems. Well, on a little more serious note, I would like to comment a little bit in terms of random observations, which I assure you have no sanction from either the regents or the president. At least a few of my viewpoints, and maybe some of these are colored by the fact that the president and my compatriots have seen fit to volunteer me several times this year to go down and be badgered by legislative committee, so my remarks are colored a little bit by some of those experiences. We had an interesting experience about 2 weeks ago, in terms of the members of the president's staff, of meeting with a special committee of the University Assembly, which had been created in order to discuss what they termed the state of the university from an internal standpoint. And some of the matters that they brought up were certainly interesting. I think we spent something like 10 or 12 hours in discussion with them, which were mutually fruitful. They were concerned about the relationships between and among the functions in the university, the teaching, research, and public service. They were concerned about the allocation of resources among these functions. They were concerned about the general image of the university, about the problems of communication, and about participation in governance. And I think as we look at some of the concerns then that we saw expressed in these people, that we have the same kind of concerns expressed by the general public and certainly by legislators. For we don't exist in a vacuum, and there are a lot of external forces with which we must deal. But in terms of what some might call as our internal problems and our external problems, I personally cannot see fit to work myself into ulcers because of some discontent and because of some conflict. I think it's much better to have a faculty and students who are concerned, and certainly if there weren't any discontent, I think we might need to organize some, because progress develops where we have the points of tension and conflict, not where things have already been settled. And I think Regent McFarland made a good reference to that point this morning in the Regents meeting when students were present and were talking about some of the problems of apathy and lack of activity inside a thing and that type of thing. And Regent McFarland says, well, maybe, you know, somebody has to organize some type of a problem before people will get interested enough in order to do something about them. I think some of the good things that are going on now internally in the university are going on not because of the particular wonderful insights of any one person or any group of person, but because of the faculty and student concerns that we have expressed. I think we're seeing the refinement and the revitalization of the University Assembly. I think it's coming of age. We're seeing the development of regional councils involving faculty and students and administration. And we're seeing efforts being made to develop models and formulae for the allocation of resources. Externally this year, I think perhaps we've had a little bit more of our share of attention, particularly legislatively. And again, some may attribute this to a great wave of discontent throughout the state. Perhaps it is a form of discontent, but I think it's a discontent not because things are worse than ever, but because our desires and our expectations are higher than ever. The desirable change and expansion just isn't coming fast enough to suit people. There are some factors which are affecting our public image and our external relations which are not entirely within our control. The economic concerns in the state, the uncertainty over pipeline permits, over what's going to be going on 10 years from now, the increasing social and educational burdens, the watchword of austerity, which we have as far as state government is concerned. These are things beyond our control, but they certainly affect us. They affect the allocation of resources, and we find that Legislators and the general public are concerned about productivity as far as university personnel. They're concerned about accountability. We had a legislative council subcommittee which worked this year in the state. We call their report popularly the Starcher Report because a gentleman by the name of George Starcher headed the committee. I think that on that committee were certainly a group of eminent people. They were known, most of them, to most of us in the university family. But I think without question that the purpose of the subcommittee coming into the state and bringing in the group was largely to deal with the concerns of private education. And I think as usual when an outside group comes in, we saw the imposition of what someone else does somewhere else, which may not be particularly applicable to university problems. So we saw a spate of legislation developed and introduced, most of which treated matters which we are already well aware of and which we are trying to do something about, such as providing greater autonomy for the regions, providing regional councils, providing advisory councils in the local community, formula for allocation of resources, this type of thing, which we're working on. In a purely personal view, I think that most of the legislation which developed out of that was not only unnecessary, but some of it was highly undesirable, because I think we saw efforts to legislate detail in terms of university organization and administration. And I think it's quite a paradox sometimes that those same people who will propose legislation to try to legislate participation and which legislates the dilution of administrative authority, yet these are the same people, when you appear before them in a committee, who put the finger on the regents and on the administration for accountability. So I personally become a bit annoyed by the type of legislation which seeks to materially alter the role of the regents, which seeks to usurp their constitutional authority. As Regent Brundin stated, I think, very well in a meeting the other day, the regents are responsible to the public. And in that capacity, they must insist on statewide excellence, and they must place the responsibility for it in the office of the president. They must insist on budgetary controls, and this can only be gained through strong administrative lines. And they must strive for maximum regional flexibility and operational control under the system of central governance, which is held finally accountable. So when we have attempts to legislate such things, to me it is particularly offensive. I think we also have perfect examples that you cannot legislate participation. You may legislate it, but you still will not have it unless the spirit of the people is with it. And again today, as we were meeting with students, and as they were talking about their problems to engender interest in student government, and to overcome apathy, and to get activities going, again, it becomes evident that you cannot legislate this type of participation. It has to come otherwise. I've always been impressed with the caliber of lay boards of education in terms of both elementary and secondary education and higher education. And this stems from a lot of years of working directly with such boards. I personally wish that more people could see the regents at work. I wish they could be aware that the regents put in 50 to 70 days a year.